The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So as I quite often say, as we're waiting is an opportunity for practice. So often we're waiting, so we go into our minds, wander around, think about this, think about that. But we can instead come into the body, because the body's right here. You can feel the warmth, the coolness, the pressure, the movement of the body. Feel the movement of each breath. Right here and now. So the Buddha point says that this body, our bodies are everything that we need to know to get enlightened is right here in this body. And we so often miss the opportunity to listen to it or to ask any questions. We immediately go off into the mind. So any time that you're waiting for something, just remember it's an opportunity just to come into the body, into the feet, or into just the whole body breathing, and that brings you directly into the present moment. And notice what you bring to that, you know, whether there's a sense of disinterest or aversion or fondness, or whatever it is that we recognize what you meet, you know, with what mind state do you meet this body that you live with every day, every night. So it's always an opportunity. Is there a formal request done normally? Formal request or not? I'm not sure. We kind of should do, shouldn't we? Because it's a chanting night. But have you ever done that? The formal request?
I don't know what you mean.
That there's a Brahma Chaloka.
Maybe once we did it.
Okay. Maybe we can do it without.
You're being recorded. You know,
already? Okay. Okay. Let's go.
But I like what you said about the whole body breathing and the whole Dharma.
It's all here. It's all here. So let's officially start. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So tonight is the half moon, and it's the winter solstice, which means it's the longest night of the year. So the solstice, the winter solstice, is kind of symbolic of the coming of the light. So we go into the darkest, longest night, and once we go through that, then the light starts to increase. So the days start to get longer, the nights start to get shorter, until we get to the summer solstice, and then we have the opposite. And on it goes, and on it goes. So the winter solstice is often really celebrated. And where I come from in Wales, there's still a lot of interest in druidry and so on. So people go out to stone circles and celebrate the solstice in various ways. I think here people light fires on Ocean Beach often on solstice. There's still a celebration. So it's symbolic of the coming of the light after a long, dark time. And it's also the 21st of December 2012. So there's been a lot of talk about this date. So some people have said 21st of December 2012 will be the end of the world. And some people say it's actually the 22nd. So we have to wait and see. And some people say it's the beginning of a new, dawning of a new humanity, that this is an opportunity for our higher consciousness to be raised and for human beings to live by their higher potential rather than by our lower potential, which it's seems to be what people are living from a lot of the time, you know, not from our highest potential. So if that's the case, and that's supposed to be tomorrow, sometime tomorrow afternoon, that there's one of the stories I heard was that there's in the centre of our galaxy there's a black hole, which is and from that black hole there's like a ray of energy emitted constantly, and once every 25,000 years Earth goes through that ray. So apparently tomorrow sometime between 2 and 4 for 8 minutes we go through that ray of energy coming out of the black hole at the centre of the galaxy, and then who knows what happens. But let's see. I don't know exactly what time it was. I was told it was between 2 and 4 for 8 minutes, but I didn't know exactly what time it was. So let's see. Maybe we start to wake up a little bit more. But whether it's, you know, whether it is the end of the world tonight or tomorrow, and whether our consciousness does get raised tomorrow, you know, by some external force, conditions, the thing is that our practice is our practice. You know, our practice remains the same. So about 2 years ago, somebody came up to me. I was at a Bayagiri monastery, and a woman came up to me really distressed and said, oh, when are the nuns going to settle? When are the nuns going to come here? Because December 21st, 2012 is coming, and, you know, and, you know, it's going to be the end of the world, and we need all the help we can get. And I said, well, you know, if it's the end of the world or not, our practice remains the same. So today might be our last day on this earth, we don't know. It could be for any of us. And if that's the case, you know, the practice is to be present and to let go of what we don't need to be holding on to. So if tomorrow afternoon the world ends, you know, what are we ready? Are we ready? What is the unfinished business? What do we have to let go of? What are we holding on to that might get in the way of us letting go at the right moment? So we tend to live in a way that's assuming continuation. And, you know, when we're younger, we think, well, we're going to carry on living until we're in our 80s or 90s. So, you know, we can enjoy ourselves now, we've got lots of time. There tends to be that way of thinking. And middle-aged kind of recognise that, you know, quite a bit of time's gone by, and maybe it's not so long, but it's still pretty long. And then as we get older, some people still, even in the 90s or 80s or 90s, haven't really acknowledged that death is going to come. You know, it's inevitable. And there's a kind of a struggling or a fighting with the natural conditions of the aging of the body and mind. And this can bring a lot of suffering. So, you know, as practitioners, we can look at this. We can look at what is our relationship to this life? How are we using this life? How are we using our minds through the day? How much of the time are we actually present in this body? You know. So we live in a culture that really exalts the mind, the thinking mind. And then we have all this technology that's visual, you know, computers and games and all that. So it's very easy just to live in the mind and not really in the body. And to distract ourselves, you know, to be living in a kind of a bit of a dream world, in a fantasy world. It's very easy to do that. It's almost, you know, encouraged. Well, it's not just almost encouraged, it's very much encouraged through the media and advertising and And all around us, so there's this kind of encouragement to live in a fantasy world. I was just at the dentist earlier on today, and I was looking at the magazines that are there for people to read, and they were all so... they're all so much in the fantasy realms, you know. They're all about superstars who look absolutely beautiful, who are healthy and wealthy, and have, you know, the best of everything, wonderful relationships, and this is given as how life should be. But when I look around the street, when I come back on the light rail, on the Muni, and I look at the people in the Muni, I don't see those people. Maybe one, once in a while. But basically I don't see those people. I see ordinary people, all sorts of shapes and sizes and colours and ages and health, varied. And that's the reality of the situation. It isn't the fantasy that we're given. So just really asking the question, how are we using our time? How well are we spending our time? How much of the time are we really present? How often can we catch ourselves when we've got lost in a dream? Or when we realise that we've been holding on to a resentment for a long time and it's harming us? You know, how often can we really tune into that and let go? So this interesting date that we're at today, you know, we can use that as an opportunity to really kind of take a good look at our lives and what we're doing with our lives and how we're using our minds and our bodies and our days. And really ask the question, is this, you know, am I making the best use of this time, of this opportunity? So the Buddha very strongly emphasizes that to have a human birth is an incredibly precious gift, even though it doesn't always seem like it. But he does very strongly emphasize that, because we have the animal drives still, the physical body with its animal drives, and that we also have the ability to reflect. And those two, and also the ability to, through practice, to realize really deep peace and bliss. So, you know, we're kind of halfway between heaven and hell, you could say. And this is the perfect place for liberation, for insight. If we're just in one or the other, then we're lost. But we're right halfway between them. We can taste both at times. And we can also find that middle ground where we're not falling into one or running after the other. But we're here. We're right here. So the Buddha was pointing to the middle way, the point between the two extremes. And one of the translations, so that the two extremes are the extreme of following sense pleasure, seeking happiness through sense pleasure, which is totally what this culture is geared towards. And the other is following extreme ascetic practices, so looking for freedom through very extreme asceticism, which is not so familiar in this country. But in other countries, some like India, there are people who do these practices. And usually these are called the two extremes, but another translation for them is that they are dead ends. And I find that very interesting. So to follow the path of sensual desire is a dead end. It doesn't lead us anywhere. It doesn't lead to the freedom that we're looking for. And you know, when we follow sensual desire, follow pleasure. It is because we're seeking that relief. You know, there's a tension or a stress starts to build up inside us, or a sense of emptiness inside us, and we look for something to relieve that. And so we eat a cake, or we go and watch a really good movie, or we, well, all kinds of things we can do. And to fill that gap or to ease that tension. And it does for a little while, and then that comes back again. The tension comes back again, the gap, that big hole inside us, it's there again. And so we seek something else, and we seek something else. And it gives us relief for a little while, and then that's gone again. So, you know, the path of sensuality, which promises so much, is a dead end. It doesn't ever take us to that place of freedom for more than a few moments. And then the path of asceticism, where we try to rid ourselves of things that we've done wrong. So we don't, in this culture, we don't kind of stand on our one leg and hold our arm in the air for 15 years, and this kind of practice that actually does happen in India. We don't do those things, but we do other things. Like one thing I think is very common and maybe rather hidden is self-criticism. You know, we don't do self-mortification so much, but we do self-criticism, self-berating, self-not-forgiving. Do a lot of that. So this is also a dead end. This does not lead to freedom from suffering. It leads to more suffering. So if we recognize that we're doing that, you know, we haven't turned up on time. We didn't do what we were supposed to do, or we weren't as successful as we thought we should be. Things didn't work out, we failed. Then we can berate ourselves and criticize ourselves, and that voice can keep going on and on and on. So that is a path that leads to a dead end. It has no benefit. It's kind of wasting our time. So just to recognize the times when that is happening, even if it's just a little voice, you know, this isn't going to help. This doesn't lead to freedom. This leads to being more caught in samsara, to increase our sense of self. So recognizing these two extremes and knowing that the path, it lies right between those two extremes, where we're not looking to fill the gap with some pleasant thought or sensation, experience, and we're not stuffing harmful intention into the space either. But there's a place between those two where there's a knowing of things as they are. We recognize things as they are. So it's not that we don't notice when we come late, or when we've made a mistake, or we've failed at something, or we've maybe done some harm. It's not that we don't notice, but that we know it for what it is, and we open to it as it is, and we feel it as it is, and we let that feeling arise and be there, and we learn from that, and we let it go. And when it's appropriate to apologize, we apologize. When it's appropriate to rectify what we've done, we do that, and we let go. So the letting go is absolutely key. And it's very tricky, you know, our minds get so sticky. We can't let go. We can't let go of that lovely thing that we want. We can't let go of that thing that we did wrong, you know, and our minds get stuck on these things. And that just to know when that happens, this is not the middle way, this is not the path to liberation. But the path to liberation is the letting go. So even if we find ourselves in the middle of that, can we let go around it? Can we have compassion for the one who made a mistake? This one. Can we have patience for the one who again follows that desire, again takes that lovely cake that we know is going to give us some problems later? You know, can we have the patience to try and train this mind to go in the right direction? So we need to keep our minds on the middle way. So if we forget that there is a middle way, we just swing from one thing to the next, endlessly like a monkey, swing from branch to branch. It never stops. But if we know that there is that middle way between the two extremes, and that is a place of letting go, it is a place of non-becoming. If we know that that's possible, then when we've swung to one extreme or the other extreme, we can just bring that thought in. You know, at this moment, in the middle of this, where is the middle way? So we might have got into a whole big story of how we're really bad and we really have done something really, we really shouldn't be like this. And we can just keep perpetuating that story, or we can recognize, you know, maybe it's a wholesome thing. Maybe we actually have done something bad and harmful and we feel remorse. So that's like, that's known as one of the guardians of the world. Sense of remorse, not guilt, but remorse. So if we're in that place of remorse because we have done something harmful, then that is our teacher, that's like our guardian, that's telling us, you know, don't do this again. It hurts. It hurts me and it hurts others. Don't do that again. So then we can just come to that feeling and be with that feeling of regret and remorse and really open to it and let it be our teacher. Even if it hurts, you know, even if it's kind of intense, just let it be there. But not feeding it with, I'm such a bad person, I really shouldn't, I. Not feeding it with that, but being with the direct experience and letting it teach us to not follow that path again. So then the next time we're stepping into that same situation, we're about to do the same thing or say the same thing again, we remember that it hurt. Just like a child learns, you know, when you touch a hot radiator, it hurts. So you don't want to do it again. It's just like that. But if we don't open ourselves to the feeling, we never learn and we just keep doing the same things again and again. And likewise with the, you know, with pleasure. Sometimes it's very difficult not to follow. But then to look at, you know, what are the, you know, is it a harmless enough pleasure to follow, or is it actually causing harm somewhere? You know, is there behind the scenes, is there harm in this? So we had a favourite chocolate. I'm not going to mention the name of it, but there was a because chocolate is one of the things we can have in the evening, one of the few things we can eat in the evening. And there was a particular chocolate bar that they have in America that they don't have in England, that we all liked. So people asked us, we'd say, oh, get us that one. And then after a while we discovered that behind the scenes of this chocolate there was slavery. There were children who were being used basically as slaves to work in the cocoa plantations and having really horrendous conditions, and that the company itself didn't mind. They knew about it. It became quite public, and they said, well, you know, a company as big as we are, there's nothing much you can do about it, you just have to do it like that. So there was no sense of really ethics or remorse or anything. So then once we realised that, then we sent this email out to a few people who were getting us this nice chocolate bars and said, thank you so much that you've been getting these lovely bars for us and we like them, but they're not worth it because this is behind the scenes. You know, so they're just looking at what is the cost of our pleasures, and is it worth it? And you know, that it's an incentive to give up something nice if you know that someone else is suffering for you to have that. But remembering again and again that, you know, the path between the two extremes is, you know, it is a path of non-becoming. So just recognizing how we create ourselves, how we attach to the feelings that arise. A pleasant feeling is something nice. We see something nice, we taste something nice, and then the mind attaches. And then there's this whole becoming process that happens. We become the one that wants that, the one that's being gratified. And then, you know, there's this becoming energy that happens. And there's also an opportunity to let go. And sometimes it's really hard to do. You know, it's a very simple teaching, let go, but it can be very hard to do. But just to play with that, explore that, you know, how is it to let go? Maybe at first it's really, really hard. Like a child, I mean, I might have mentioned before, but in when we lived in Amravati, there were a lot of Thai and Sri Lankan people would come in our monastery in England. And in Thailand, the children, the little children, right from when they're babies, they're taught to offer food into the alms bowl. So the parents will have them, and the monks and nuns will go by with their alms bowls, which we eat out of. And the little child will be there holding a candy or something, or a fruit, and looking at it, they want that, that's nice, and they want it themselves. And then the parent says, put it into the bowl. And they're like, that's my candy. No, put it in. And then they kind of hesitate, and then they put it in, and then everyone goes, oh, very good. And they're like, oh, good, okay. So they learn from a very young age that it's a good to give, even to give what you want for yourself. You know, it's a lovely, beautiful thing, actually. And so just that, in a learning to let go of what is pleasurable, it's a, you know, we let go of what will give us an instant pleasure, and then we get a greater pleasure. So those little children, they learn, they feel really good afterwards, because everyone's saying, oh, you did great, that was wonderful. And then we chant a blessing, and then the Sangha blesses them, and then they get all of this good feeling from giving. And they would have got a good feeling from eating as well for a little while, but it's a different good feeling. Then they grow up with that sense that giving is a good thing, generosity is a good thing, it feels good, it's joyful, it's a beautiful thing to do. So this is a much greater pleasure than the pleasure of getting and having. Because getting and having, you know, you have it for a little while and it's gone. Whereas when you can, you know, when you give something really good and with real heart and presence, that kind of stays with you for a long time. And also receiving, you know, if you can receive the generosity of others, the kindness and generosity of others, it's beautiful. It's something that stays in the heart, you know, you remember that. So it's letting go of the smaller pleasures and moving towards the greater pleasures of freedom of heart, generosity, kindness, patience, compassion. And, you know, as we keep going, as we keep working in that direction, gradually the heart and mind frees up. It doesn't keep on attaching. It doesn't. The things that were once so important, they just kind of aren't anymore. It doesn't matter anymore. And the joy of giving to someone is greater than the joy of having. So this is the beauty of renunciation. You know, we tend to think that renunciation is giving up. You give up, then it's kind of austere, and you give everything up. But renunciation is giving up something good that gives you joy in order to receive something greater than that. If we never give it up, we never know the greater joy. And the greatest joy is the joy of enlightenment, the joy of the free heart. It's actually my name, Joy of Enlightenment, Ananda Bodhi. I haven't realized it yet, but fully. But that's when we know, when we even just taste the joy of giving and the joy of giving up, it's so much greater than any joy of getting, having, becoming. It's so much greater, so much sweeter, so much cleaner and freer and more whole than any joy that we can have from getting. So just to remember that, you know, when we're angling to get our way or have what we want, you know, just remember that there's a much greater freedom and happiness available right here, every moment. And we, you know, we're living here in this world, and we all seek happiness. You know, everyone seeks happiness. Everyone seeks safety, happiness. And as we know, it's not a safe world. You know, there's the natural aging process, the fact that these bodies are going to die at some point, and then there's the wild cards, as we just recently experienced in Connecticut, you know, this crazy young man opening fire on little children, 6 and 7 year old children. Really, really tragic. Really heartbreaking. You know, and this happens, you know. And America seems to be one of the worst places for this to be happening. Because people are filling their minds with violence, and it becomes normal to for the mind to be experiencing violence and aggression and excitement, adrenaline. It becomes normal, but it isn't normal. It's a kind of sickness that's crept its way in over the years into the minds of good people. And it's very, very harmful, very destructive. So, you know, like when you were all taking the 5 precepts earlier on, always when I hear people taking the precepts, I have this feeling of like, oh, it's such a beautiful thing to hear people taking the 5 precepts. Because in keeping those precepts, you're like a source of safety to the world. Even if you weren't going to break them anyway, but you're making a clear declaration that you want to, in this world, be a source of safety. And that's very precious. Because there's a lot of crazy people out there. Some of them in very high positions. So, you know, it's up to each of us to do the practice and to pick up, you know, the ethics and the interest and presence, the interest in what is happening in the present, and to get to know our own minds, because we all have violence within us. We all have the seeds of violence within us, and we all have the seeds of awakening within us. So we have to really be careful, you know, not to pretend that we don't have it, because we all do, unless we're anagami, which is pretty high up there, unless we're free from wanting and not wanting. We all have those seeds in us, so we have to be careful, you know, when we see those seeds germinating. It might be just a little seed that's kind of starting to be irritated by somebody, and then starting to really dislike them, and then starting to hate them. Be careful. You know, that is a seed of harm. So we have to keep rooting them out. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the little prince. Does anyone know that story? It's one of my favourite stories. This little prince who lives on a planet, little planet, and on this little planet there are baobab seeds, which is baobab is this enormous, enormous tree. And so every day he goes out and he looks for these baobab seeds, and he roots them out and tosses them off his planet. Because if they grow, they'll just break the whole thing up into pieces. So it's the same with our own hearts and minds. We've got to watch out for those seeds, because they might just be little seeds, but they can grow really big. So when we find them, you know, to root them out, dig them out, and you know, don't water them with more thoughts of, you know, criticism or hatred or resentment, whatever it might be. But root them out. Once you spot them, root them out, because they can grow really big. And then the, you know, the wholesome intentions, give them plenty of sun. Give them the light of your awareness. Give them your kindness, interest, so that you cultivate what's wholesome, you grow strong in what is wholesome, and you diminish and eventually root out what is unwholesome. So it's an ongoing practice in this garden of the heart and mind. As we know, if you leave the garden for a while, the weeds grow really quick, especially if it's been raining. So you have to keep going, you have to keep working at it. But that is the practice. Keep on going. Keep on spotting those seeds that you want to root out. Keep on watering the plants that will give you shelter, you know, will give you a place of, like a refuge. And, you know, day by day, don't let a day go by without doing this practice. At least for a few minutes, if not for an hour, if not for the whole day. Don't let a day go by without turning your mind to the Dhamma and to your potential. It's too precious, because this might be our last day, we don't know. Any day could be our last day. So take the opportunity now, because it's given to us. So sometimes our minds are used to looking at what's wrong and used to just sliding into sensual attraction or desire or fantasy, because that's what we're bombarded with all the time through the media and so on. We're bombarded with those images. I don't look at them so much, but you know, even just going out into the city, you know, it's all there. It's the billboards and the media is continuously bombarding us with these images, and so, you know, really making effort to cultivate what's good in here and to catch when the mind is getting lost. It takes effort, practice, and interest. And it's also very important that we don't limit our perception of who we are. So if we think of ourselves, if I think, I'm a good person, I'm a Buddhist nun, I'm a good person, then when the kind of not so nice stuff comes up, then I can't take it in. Because, oh no, that's not me, I'm not like, no. I'm a good person, I'm a Buddhist nun, I don't think there's no. So then I'm kind of pushing it away rather than taking interest in what's going on. But if I don't have that sense of I'm something or other, and I just meet what arises now, then I can learn from it. Then I can be honest about the difficult stuff that's in here, and also about the beauty and the potential and the goodness that's in here. So if we have a perception of ourselves of being hopeless and, you know, no good, and that's what we were told when we were young, so we really believe that's really how we are, then we don't see what's good. We miss it. So it's very important to consciously turn your mind, have a look at what is good. What good have I done today? What is wholesome about this human being? What unwholesome things have I not done that I thought of doing? What have I restrained that could have been harmful that I haven't acted on? And just each day, I really encourage you each day, at the end of the day, to look at that. Do a little reconnaissance. Have a look at what's here, and, you know, train your mind to see what is wholesome and to develop and encourage what is wholesome. So we live with these bodies, which are our greatest teacher. Teacher on impermanence, teacher on no self, it's constantly changing body, teacher on dukkha, difficulties. You know, the body is teaching us, pointing us to these truths all the time. And, you know, we live with these teachers, we go to bed at night with these teachers, we eat our meals with these teachers. They're with us all the time. So learning to turn our mind to this body, not just as does it look nice, is it pretty, is it healthy, but what is it teaching me? What is this body telling me now? The breath is teaching impermanence. It's teaching interconnection. It's teaching about rising and falling. All of these teachings are going on all the time. But we just need to put our mind in the right place, in the right, attune our minds in the right way and investigate this body and mind. So, you know, we all have everything that we need, believe it or not. And we just have to really remember. It's a lot of it's just about remembering. Remembering to look in the right way, turn our minds in the right way, investigate. And if we really apply that, if we do apply our practice, then we will experience greater and greater freedom. That's certain. So the Buddha's path is a path of liberation, freedom from suffering. So I'd like to offer that for reflection this evening. And maybe if there's about 5 minutes of questions if people have, because there may be important bits that I've missed out that you need to fill in, and then we'll end with some chanting. Please.
So, how do you forgive yourself?
How do you forgive yourself? I think the first thing is to recognize that you're human, and human beings are, I like to say, perfectly imperfect. So sometimes we expect ourselves to be absolutely perfect, but we are not. You know, we're imperfect, and that is the perfection of, in a way of how we are. So, you know, if we've done harm in the past intentionally, then it's important to do what you can to rectify that. So if you've actually intentionally harmed someone else or caused distress intentionally, then an apology is good. If the person that you've harmed is no longer alive, then you can still kind of ask forgiveness from them. And I think also to really discern the difference between making mistakes, being imperfect, and intentionally harming another person or another being or another situation. So there's a really big difference between just the fact that we haven't learnt better yet and that we intentionally went out there to cause harm. And if we have intentionally gone out there to cause harm, then open your heart to that feeling, the painful feeling that arises through that. And let that be like the door that leads to the ending of suffering. So really opening your heart to the pain of having intentionally harmed another person or another situation or being. Really opening yourself to that, it hurts. You know, and that when we feel the pain of that, then we don't want to keep doing it. So that is it's like the first noble truth. We feel the suffering, we recognize the cause of it, and we let go of the cause of it. So we don't keep doing that again and again. And recognizing how we berate ourselves. So if that's just continuously going on, berating, that's also kind of a harm, harming ourselves. So, you know, maybe some berating is good because it wakes us up and it stops us doing the same thing again and again. But there comes a point where you've got to just stop that and say, okay, I made a mistake and it had that effect. And I would really be glad if it hadn't happened, but it did happen. And, you know, you've taken the time to feel it, acknowledge it, maybe rectify what you can. And then you have to put it down and move on. Because if we just store up all the things we've done wrong, you know, it's like we have this big bag of stuff that we've done wrong, that we were wrong, we were bad, and we didn't do properly, and we're just completely burdened all the time. And we don't have to live like that. You know, we all make mistakes. The Buddha, he made a kind of enormous, I mean, I shouldn't say he made a mistake, but he, as an enlightened Buddha, he taught a group of monks to practice the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body. And he taught quite a large group of monks, and then he went off to meditate. I think it was a 3-month rains retreat, so he taught them, and then they to get on with that practice, and then he went off to practice on his own. And when he came back, what had happened was that they'd picked it up in the wrong way, and they'd identified with their bodies as being dirty and unclean and awful, and then people were actually killing themselves. And then they were even asking someone else, they'd ask someone else, will you please kill us? You'll make a lot of merit if you kill us because we've got these impure bodies. You know, they completely took the teaching in the wrong way. So he came back from his meditation retreat to find all these people who'd followed his instruction wrong, who were, you know, killing themselves and asking other people to kill them. So it's horrendous. Can you imagine? So he made a kind of big blunder there in not giving a balanced teaching. And then as a result of that, he taught mindfulness of breathing. That's when the mindfulness of breathing teaching came in. He said, you know, put that practice to one side for now and practice mindfulness of breathing instead. So, you know, even the Buddha, a fully enlightened Buddha, made a mistake there, kind of a pretty big one. That's how it is. We learn as we go along. And probably none of us have made such a mistake that's had such consequences. but so not continue, you know, to recognize when enough's enough, you know, don't just keep on that same old track of I should have, I could have, I would have, and just say, okay, it's time to put it down now, start again. New breath, new step, new morning. And put your energy into what's good, not continuously into what's wrong. And sometimes we have to, like I was saying before, sometimes we have to train our minds to notice what's good because we're so used to noticing what's wrong. We have to kind of turn our attention to what is good consciously. Even write it down if you need to because it's so used to looking at what's wrong. So it's training the mind. And then we get more of a balanced outlook. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I think I'm going to have to stop there because the time's almost up.